It's really nice to be here in a great session. Alex told me to talk about both of the big things that I'd be doing in my lab, so I'm going to sort of touch on both of them in a shallow depth instead of going deeply into one or the other. So I'm going to start with talking. So we have two high throughput phenotyping approaches in the lab. One is elemental profiling, the other is phenomics or image-based phenotyping. So we'll start with the elemental phenotype, and that's what we call ionomics, the ionome being all of the inorganic ions within a cell, tissue, or organism. And the reason we think this is a valuable trait is twofold. One is these elements can tell you a lot about what's going on, and they are universal. So these elemental traits are found in every living thing. And so while the processes that underlie them as traits change from organism and environment, the traits themselves are constant. And so that helps us to think about this across many species and many different systems. And also because these are incredibly important nutrients for us. And so we actually, the things that are on vitamin labels, a lot of them are things that we measure. And so we want to getting more of the good stuff, less of the bad stuff is obviously sort of the long-term goal of our research. So to do this type of analysis, we have developed this pipeline in my lab. We call it the ionomics pipeline. It's in cartoon form here. Almost everything we do is field-grown plants, which means that we have a tremendous number of great collaborators and who send us samples. The pipeline was designed for corn and soybeans, although we can do a wide variety of species and tissues. And Duke will actually tell you a little bit about cotton ionomics that we've done afterwards. If we have robots to do the weighing of seeds, for leaves we have to do different approaches, but once we have the sample in a tube, we then throw in a little bit of hot acid and let it digest and get rid of all the boring carbohydrates, fats, proteins, stuff. And we're left with the interesting stuff, which is the elements in solution, and those go on to 96 well plates, and six of those, so 576 samples go on to the inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer, which can measure 20 elements in every sample. And we can do that in 33 hours, and so we turn that crank three times a week. And we've been doing that for longer than I'd care to admit and longer than that kid who was in the previous slide was alive. And we're already up to 250,000 plus samples. And so for statisticians, I will say that we're working really hard to make a lot of this data is available online. It's not as accessible as I would like it to be, and we're working on that. But it's a really rich data set that we've only really started to mine. And so we're really interested in trying to understand the elemental composition of data that we have in light of the genetics and environment that we've been where the plants were grown. So one of the things about the elemental profile is for plants is that it's a really great indicator of the interaction between the genetics of the plant and its environment. Because if you think of the above ground tissues, to get elements up there, except for carbon and oxygen, basically everything else had to come through the soil environment into the roots and then get transported up into the leaves through the movement of water, and then there's many processes that go on the leaves, and some of them then gets remobilized and gets into the seeds. And so the elemental profile is an indicator of many complex plant processes, and it's sort of a summary readout, and we just don't know what we're reading out. And so, but that's what we're trying to do. So I want to just take you through a few experiments that we've done. Briefly just sort of show how we started to think about the data. This is a fairly moderate-sized experiment, actually. This is the maize IBM population. It's a recombinant inbred population. The maize community has studied it a lot, and so we were able to obtain samples from it from many different grouts, including multiple-year grouts from several locations. And Ali Asaro, grad student, and Greg Ziegler, who's basically the jack of all trades in the lab, they did a lot of work to analyze this data. And it's, like I said, it's 1,200 plots across 10 environments and 77,000 samples, 7,700 samples. But once you do 20 elements, all of a sudden the data starts to get large enough that you're not looking at it all in Excel and making anything meaningful out of it. So Obviously, the first thing we can do is treat these elements as individual traits and do QTL analysis across environments. When we do that, we get some QTLs that are found in multiple different environments for different elements. But most of the QTLs we find are specific for a grow-out. And I won't go into all the detail, but we've done a lot to convince ourselves that these are actual QTLs and not artifacts on either side. And so one of the things that tells us, and we have other data to show this, is that this trait, as you might expect, is really responsive to gene-by-environment interactions. And so which genes you're going to find and which loci you're going to find is dependent on the environment that you grow it in. And this is across environments. Duke is going to show you some within environment variability, maybe. But that's really one of the things we're really trying to get back and try and understand is what is the correlations and what are the factors, the environmental factors that are underlying these differences. But this is treating each of these elemental traits as an individual, independent trait. That's how we measure it on the machine. But in reality, we know that that's not true. They're not independent traits. And so this is an old study that we did, basically showing that lots of single mutants, so single gene insertion mutants, have multi-element phenotypes, and those phenotypes vary as you go into different environments. And we have lots of examples of this. This is from Arabidopsis, but we see this across many different experiments. And we actually think that the element, the ionome, is something more like this, where every element is interacting with multiple different elements. And if you're only looking at single traits, you're missing the actual signal that's moving lots of different elements. And so we think that's really important, that even if you're only interested in one element, that you actually take into account what's happening to other elements. But what this means is that you shouldn't really treat these as independent traits, which is great, except the question is then how do you treat this as a multiple element trait when these correlations between elements change within different environments. And so we're trying to do, in terms of pitching something that statisticians, I would love for you guys to think about and help us think about, this is one of our sort of central questions now. And in fact, I wanted to ask it so much that I wrote an opinion piece asking it so that everyone could read it and then tell us what we should do. The answer, I think, is both, but you guys can certainly show me I'm wrong. I'd be happy to learn better ways to do this. The simplest thing we've been doing is taking a principal component approach where we do PCAs, and instead of using it for data reduction, we just assume that we have sort of inverted the matrix or figured it around and come up with multi-element traits and then repeat our QTL mapping on that. When we do that across environments, you can easily see in the first two principal components strong environmental signals, and it's not just growth location. So if you have two grow-outs from Florida, they're showing up in different parts of the principal component space. And so it's not just what field you grow it in, it's what field you grow it in and what was the environment in that year. And so we're really trying to suss out those connections with environmental variables. And we're the G2F experiments that people are doing in maize, we think are going to be a really good tool for us to dissect that. When we do the actual QTL analysis, we do find things that we would expect, where you found multiple elements having a QTL, you get a principal component QTL right there. But we also get things where you had multiple where you get a principal component QTLs where you had absolutely no signal for single element traits. And so there are small variations in multiple elements that all of a sudden we pick up loci that are controlling them when we take this sort of principal component approach and get a fresh look at the underlying variation. And when we compare those, we find that you get some QTLs that are unique for the single element approach, some that are unique for the principal component approach. Most of the QTLs appear to be shared, and you're just looking at it from different sides of the Rubik's Cube. So I think this is why I say it's probably complementary, is that there is ways to get signal in both of them that you may not get with each one. It does make for very hard to compare across species and experiments when this principal component approach is so variable. Ideally, to really understand this, we want to clone the genes underlying all these QTLs. And that's sort of the needle in the haystack that we want to get to. QTL analysis maybe gets you to a handful, probably gets you to a half bale or something once you really think about it. And so we've done a lot of going the next step, which is probably genome-wide association mapping. And so to summarize years and years of work into one slide, we've been really working on this across with these really powerful genetic populations that people have developed, and we have data for all these different types of populations with, again, just to emphasize, great collaborators who've helped us with samples and analysis and thinking through all the experiments. I'm not going to tell you any individual stories. We have tons of data that we're starting to try and push the papers out in the giving the first descriptions. We decided to develop the browser for all the results because we have all these traits, and it was really hard to look at the traits on a element-by-element basis. And so we developed this interactive GWAS results browser that you could put multiple traits in multiple locations and then zoom in and zoom out and have it be very interactive. And we like it a lot, and several people who use it like it a lot. So if you're trying to look at lots of different GWAS results, I highly and completely in an unbiased fashion recommend it. But going back to this, so the GWAS is great. It gets you smaller regions of the genome. It does not get you down to genes, as you guys probably know. And so one of the things we wanted to see is how do we leverage all the data we have and try and identify novel genes in an unbiased way. And one of the things that we think is that a lot of the pathways underlying these elemental traits are going to be very old in evolutionary time. And so some of them will be conserved across species. And so we wanted to develop tools to look across species for common genes under QTL and GWAS peaks. And it's turned out to be a fairly long endeavor with lots of different people in my lab and in other labs. And we've developed one tool that has evolved a lot. We started just trying to take blast hits under GWAS peaks, which worked fine, but we realized that we didn't have a good idea for deciding what a random approach would get you in the same way, and the BLAST database quickly started getting out of date. So the new version that we have working but is not public uses phytosome orthologs, so we don't have to worry about it. We'll let phytosome worry about it. And then we've developed lots of ways to do bootstrapping to figure out what's real and what's not when we do these comparisons. And so what we now have is a way to compare four different organisms at once with randomized data sets and with our real data set and look at the distribution in terms of number of genes that we're finding under these peaks. And so this is the output that we're using now. And so for each run, each element, you get a distribution in the four species from your bootstraps, and then in red is the number of genes you found in that species in the real data. So for iron, it looks like we're not really seeing a signal from this comparison. And that's not totally unexpected. We know that very diverse species can have very diverse ways of acquiring their iron. Things look a little bit better for magnesium, but the one that we're really excited about right now is zinc. So here's the distribution of the bootstraps, and here's the number of genes we have. And so this is enough evidence for me to say that it's worth us spending time now checking and confirming these predictions that we have. We have now a predicted set that we can test, and so we're going to do that in Rabidopsis because that's still the best way to say I want to order a knockout and run it. So that's what we're doing with the Ionomics, and now let me completely switch gears and talk about the phenotyping. So the Danforth Center has made a big investment in phenotyping. We have lots of different systems now online. You saw the Scanalyzer in Kelly's talk. You're going to probably hear more about that, and that's at Maricopa, and that's a joint project between USDA at Maricopa, Arizona, Danforth Center, and many other groups. And then recently, NSF has funded a root X-ray CT system at the Danforth Center with Chris Topp. And we also have a lot of interest in cheaper, simpler Raspberry Pi-based phenotyping. But the thing that really kicked off phenotyping at the Danforth Center was the Bellwether phenotyping facility we have, which is a LenaTech facility. It's got a controlled environment greenhouse that can fit 1,100 plants. And then there's plants are on conveyors. They can get weighed in water multiple times a day and then move through imaging loop that has two stations on it now, a visible and an NIR. And the plants can get imaged either every other day or every day. And so this came online in 2012. Mindy Wilson was hired to run it, and it's been fantastic. And we really have now sort of figured out what the heck we're doing with this system, which is good. It's been a key process. We had some fits and starts early on, but we've really now really started moving through. And this figure is probably old. We're probably closer to 3.5 or 4 million images collected at this point. And we've put the system was designed with the thought that we would be doing model plants, smaller plants, but you can see maize coming up here, and sorghum is going to keep going like this. So I think in terms of the funding, the system's booked for the next 2.5 years fully, and a large chunk of that is going to be sorghum. So we're moving for, so obviously the smaller plants, you can go longer into the life cycle. Sort of the bigger plants, you're doing more rapid experiments looking at early growth cycle stresses. And so and one of the things we discovered really early, as Kelly mentioned, is that data analysis is huge. And so three incredibly talented postdocs sort of started and ended up building this system called PlantCV, which we think is going to be a really powerful system going forward for image-based phenotyping. It's all based on open source tools. It's fully configurable. You can batch things through there. It's based on Python, so it's fairly intuitive and easy for biologists to use. And it allows you to really process these millions of images in a way that as you develop more traits, you can go back and continue to evolve it. And so we're really at the very beginning of this process in terms of what we're pulling out of the images, but you can see that we're going to be able to do more, and this has really been foundational for us in the phenotyping sphere, allowing us to go forward. So this is a pipeline that Max Feldman in my lab built for NIR, and you can see there's lots of different steps where he's thresholding and figuring out what is plant, what isn't plant, where is the plant, and what are the characteristics of the plant, and then he brings all these images together, and you get, as an output, you're obviously going to get lots of a database with measurements in it, but you also get sort of an annotated view if you want. As you're developing these traits, you can do iteratively figure out, like, okay, Matt, tell me what you think is plant and what isn't, and figure out what's going on and what's going wrong. And a lot of these images are already posted. Again, we're definitely trying to post lots of images, and I think there's a real opportunity in the image-based phenotyping space for us to be moving towards competitions and open data to really get to novel traits and really improved understanding of phenotypes. Okay, so let me tell you a couple quick stories before Alex stands up and I'm out of time. These are all the work in my lab on the phenotyping system is on this little model grass called Ceteria viridis, which is very well placed among really important C4 grasses to be a model. It's got all the things we like in terms of small stature, rapid cycling, sequence genome, transformation, and a lot of tools that are being developed. And so it's a really great system for understanding C4 and plant biology in general. And we had a DOE grant that we are just about to enter our fifth year of, led by Tom Brunel, with lots of different people from different universities. This is one of our big field plantings in Illinois, which is super fun in the middle of summer. but it's been a really fantastic experience, and I think we're really starting to learn some great things from this. And so, as part of this project and from other previous people, Max and several postdocs have gone out. They've collected a ton of wild Ceteria viridis. You notice that they can drive the highways, just get off every 50 miles and find Ceteria each place. So that makes it collection trips fairly boring, but quite productive. So And so we have great resources there. You can see some of them. These are all the same day on the phenotyper of these different collections. The thing we started with and been working a lot really hard with is Ceteria viridis, which is our model, and a cross between it and the domesticated Ceteria italica, which is foxtail millet used for birdseed around here, but is a food crop in China. So that we have a real population that we've been working with. We've done lots of experiments out in the field. These are one of the field experiments we planted. These are rainout shelters, so you're doing a controlled drought in the field. And then we have the bellwether where we can do a controlled drought, a really, really controlled drought on the machine and know exactly how much water we're adding. And so as a sort of a test case for all this, pulling all this data together, out in the field, they collect many, many traits. Obviously, on the phenotyper, we collect many, many traits. And then we have to figure out some way to analyze all of that. And so that's one of the things that Max has really done on the project, which is develop QTL and GWAS pipelines to analyze all of these traits from all these different growouts and across time. And we've had that's been a big learning experience. And to sort of test out the whole process, we thought we would go with a very, quote-unquote, simple trait, which is plant height. In the field, we're still measuring that by hand with barcode scanners and rulers, but it's still measured by hand, and we don't start that earlier in the growth cycle. On the phenotyper, you can define height a bunch of different ways. We call it top of the pot to the highest point that we know is plant, but it's a shorter experiment because we are in these small pots, and eventually you run out of room. So when we do QTL analysis across all those experiments, we found that most of the QTL are shared across the experiments you get. And these are the 9 QTLs we find that are in almost all of the experiments. Red means that the domesticated allele increases height. Blue means the wild allele increases height. And you can see that we get tall alleles from both parents in the population. Of course, one of the really neat things about the phenotyper is that we can track these traits through time. So now this is now a QTL analysis across time. So here are the 9 chromosomes of Ceteria, and then this is time on the system. And you can see we have one really large QTL that starts, and then it fades a little bit. And then you have other QTLs coming at later in the growth cycle. And that's in both wet and dry. And one of the things, the main things we're finding is that we don't think the genetic identity of these alleles is changing much in between the treatments, but the timing of when those alleles are happening is changing. And so that's sort of indicated here. You can see that these are the 3 main QTLs that you get when you look in the time-dependent approach. This one is the big one where coming from the wild allele gets you taller, and you can see it acts very early and goes away, whereas these other 2 alleles are acting later. And so if you stratify our population by these 3 alleles, you can see the tallest one is always with the wild allele for this middle loci and the B1 and the domesticated for the other 2. And then you get the B100 parent that has all 3 B100 alleles. It's the next tallest, but it was slow in the earliest, and then you have this crossover happening. And so this time-dependent analysis is telling us that this QTL for height is acting very early, and other alleles are acting very late. And so it's this kind of thing that we think we're going to get from the time-dependent analysis of these kinds of traits, and obviously this is just one trait, and we're really starting to think about how we're going to sort of integrate all of these. I think is a big question, and certainly there's tons of data analysis in the background that Max had to do just to get ourselves into this point where we could do this, and it's certainly not as standard as your normal QTL analysis. So how do you incorporate time factors into your QTL analysis is something I think that is still a developing field, and we're still sort of riding along. I mentioned GWAS. We can obviously do this. We have the diversity panel has been grown on the system, and we commandeered our GWAS viewer, and instead of making the p-value be the y-axis. We made time now, and so now you're just sort of looking at trying to make a copy of that sort of time-dependent QTL analysis I showed you. And you can see there are some loci that show up early and some that show up late, and there are definitely clusters in the different experiments. And so we're seeing a lot of these loci pop up, and so we think that's going to be a lot of value in the GWAS. And this is, there's no time-dependent model involved here. This is simply taking each day as a trait and doing a GWAS analysis across it and seeing what we get. So obviously, I think that's the GWAS analysis is lagging behind the standard QTL analysis in that respect. And if somebody has ways of thinking about time-dependent GWAS, please see me afterwards, because that sounds cool. So that's just height, right? So and obviously we can do so much more. I mean, we know how much water was added to every pot at every day in this process. And we know that counting pixels is a very good estimate of biomass on the system. We've shown that. So that allows us to do what's an important trait for lots of physiologists and breeders, which is water use efficiency. And so we can look at those plots over time. This is an artifact of the dry down. We're going to fix that by changing our definition of water to be how much water was lost from the pot instead of how much was added. So, but we can do all these things, and then there's all sorts of things that you could extract from those images for plant shape, flowering time. I had two high school students who went through and tagged every panicle in at least half of the images from all of our experiments. They were not very happy with me about that. But actually, it was kind of interesting. It was interesting. Bill Gates visited the Danforth Center this spring, and I actually told him about that data set, and he thought that was really cool. So I got to email one of the high school students and said, "You know, you were complaining about all that stuff. Bill Gates thought that was cool." So it pays off in the end. So anyway, we've got a lot. I think we're going to have so many more traits, and this is, I'm really hoping that we can keep coming back to these images. The nice thing is they're only terabytes of data. So we just have to store it. But I think as we get better at thinking about these traits, there's more things we're going to be able to pull out of these data sets. And this is only about the QTL analysis. That's only 70, 80,000 images, and we've got millions. So there's so much stuff that we can do with these things as we go forward, and I'm really looking forward to that. Okay. So I told you a bunch of different stories. I tried to highlight collaborators on the slides where we had them. We've got amazing collaborators on so many different projects, and it's important. That's why I try and do it during the talk, because at the end it's kind of pointless. Core funding for my lab is USDA ARS. That's really important. We would not have the Ionomics pipeline without it. National Science Foundation and the Plant Genome Program in particular gave us the foundational grant that funded all the maize work you saw and the development of all those tools that I was highlighting. And then all the Soteria work is done on a DOE grant. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you. Dr. Poland.
So back in the day, we did a bunch of that PCA multivariate analysis for maize diseases. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the problem. If you're going to follow up, so I think they're real. I think the only way we're going to be able to really show that is if we can clone a gene for one of them, and then make a knockout and go back out there and show that it has a multi-ion effect. Oh, sorry. So Jesse thinks that the PCA approach is generally getting us just bolt. Artifactual QTLs, and is wondering how we're sure that that approach is going to be valuable. I'm not sure that the PCA approach is, and so one of the things that, as I mentioned, you can take the loadings from principal components and use those as a trait. And so we're going to do a couple things. One is we've done the PCA approach in each environment, and we've shown through clustering of loadings that there are clusters of loadings that you get across different environments. Suggests to me that that's one thing that will help. We have you probably, or people who know the Mace community might know, that there's a lot of common NAM growouts in our set, and so we can take the loadings and project those onto the NAM or onto the diversity panel, and the hope is then that we're going to be able to sort of get down and actually predict a gene, and from there, that's my proof that it's really working. We're also really interested in sort of more formalized ways of representing these traits that aren't as unsupervised clustering, and so there is an approach that some statisticians have developed. It's called nutrient balance, where you create sort of a tree of balances between the different elements. And that's, and so in theory, that would be something that would be more generalizable, and you could then use more widely.